Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris plans to meet Ghanaian President in the capital, Accra.
The visit by the Vice President of the country is very important to the people of Ghana. It symbolizes the deepening democracy as far as Ghana is concerned.
The head of the European Union Poll Observer Mission says Nigeria needs political will to improve the performance of its elections.
There was a high level of interference and obstruction that led to very low levels of voter participation. And the types of incidents that we're referring to, unfortunately, include political violence, voter suppression, vote buying, and intimidation.
And President Joe Biden and his administration back U.S. bid to host Expo 2027 in Minnesota. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Vice President Kamala Harris is scheduled to meet Ghanaian President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo this weekend in the capital, Accra. The meeting kicks off Harris's week-long African trip. She is the highest-profile official from the Biden administration to visit the continent. After Ghana, she will continue to Tanzania, where she plans to meet President Samia Suluhu Hassan, and then to Zambia to meet President Hakainde Hichilema. Harris' trip, analysts say, is the administration's effort seeking to deepen relations with the continent as well as counter China's influence. For analysis of her trip to Ghana, I reached Dr. Isaac Owusu. He is a political science lecturer at the University of Ghana, Lagos.
You know, Ghana and America's relationship is one of the very important ones for the country. And therefore, the visit by the Vice President of the country is very important to the people of Ghana. It symbolizes the deepening democracy as far as Ghana is concerned, because we know that the American president will not visit a country that is not democratic. So the Vice President coming here, people are very excited to receive her in spite of the difficulties that we are going through as a country. And it's expected that while she's in the country, she'll have a better understanding of some of the issues that the country is confronting. And I also know that she's going to be in Cape Coast. And therefore, people in Cape Coast are also expecting that one of their own is the Vice President of the United States of America. And therefore, her visit to Cape Coast is also very important and very significant to the tourism and also significant to the people of Cape Coast as well.
Looking from the government side, what positives can you draw from this visit?
One, we know that we have a difficulty as far as this country is concerned, as far as the economy of the country is concerned. So we know that while she's here, there may be some agreement here and there that will be signed between Ghana government and American government as well. And therefore, the government of Ghana is in high expectation. We also know very well that Ghana is working out to get approval from the IMF for a number of opportunities within the Bretton Woods institutions. So therefore, the government of this is looking at high anticipation of meeting her and ensuring that some of these dividends will eventually pan out. We shouldn't forget that the president of Ghana, while he was also in the United States of America, visited her, and they have a bilateral talks on some issues and some promises that were made. So it is expected that while she's here, some of them will be cemented, and therefore the country will come to a conclusion about some of the proposals that were made at the time, some of the output that we expect from such meetings that were held in Washington will be in full fruition while she's in the country as well. Let me say that her coming is not so much of excitement as the time of President Clinton coming to Ghana, because that was the first time an American president was coming to Ghana. And we shouldn't forget that after President Clinton came, President Bush also came to Ghana, and also President Obama also came to Ghana. So her coming it's very important to raise the issue that, after all, Ghana has not been forgotten, because we had three presidents in succession who visited the country. But unfortunately, when Donald Trump came in as a president, he could not visit us, and now that the vice president of the Republican Party also visited Ghana. So issues coming. The people of Ghana are looking up to that. Look, after all, we are still getting our position back as a country that almost every president continues to visit. And we mean president of the United States, whom the last three presidents were visited. So her coming is very important for Ghana.
Talking about the warm diplomatic relations that exist between Washington and Accra, how deepened do you think this visit will be into boost the significance of the relations between these two countries?
Sure, it will boost the significance of the relation between these two countries. Not only boost the significance, but also deepen the relationship as well. You know that America virtually represents the West. Therefore, and Ghana also supports the West. I'm sure you have followed up that our president has made it clear that he does not support Russia in this war. He fully supports the West. So when he comes in this country, I'm sure the president will take opportunity also to retreat and also emphasize the position that we hold as a country. I know Ghana is very, very Ghana, even though it's a smaller country, but it's very important in the global affairs. You know, in November, the president chaired the United Nations Security Council. So her coming here will surely deepen the relationship, not only on paper that we keep reading or even read as textbook for people, but also in presence, and also share some key ideas and key projects that I know that the two countries eventually are going to benefit from. You know, the United States of America military has been very, very present in Ghana in terms of helping with the training, in terms of helping with equipment. And you also know that some Ghanaian military also come to United States of America to also engage in that, whilst Americans also come here and they are involved in joint training operations here and there. So her coming is very, very significant, and it's deepening the relationship between the two.
Dr. Isaac Owusu is a political science lecturer at the University of Ghana, Lagos. He spoke with me from the capital, Accra. In Nigeria, the head of the European Union Poll Observer Mission says political will is needed to improve the performance of elections in the country. Barry Andrews also says problems during recent elections cannot be solely blamed on the Independent National Electoral Commission or INEC. Barry is an Irish politician who serves as Member of Parliament for the Dublin constituency. His remarks follow a press conference by the organization after the results of last week's gubernatorial and state assembly elections. Many Nigerians expressed concern about voter irregularities, intimidation, harassment, and rigging. For an assessment of the recent elections in Nigeria, I reach the head of the EU Poll Observer Mission, Barry Andrews.
What we said in our statement was that unfortunately there was a high level of interference and obstruction that led to very low levels of voter participation. And the types of incidents that we're referring to unfortunately include political violence, voter suppression, vote buying, and intimidation of officials from the Electoral Commission. So it was disappointing on that front, and we did record some positive elements, of course, particularly the fact that the polling opened on time and that the technology worked well in most of the areas where we had our observers in the field.
There were cases of reported violence during this recent gubernatorial election. What were some of your findings?
Yes, there were many examples of violence during the course of Saturday. And very sadly, 21 people are known to have died in political violence on Saturday, which is completely unacceptable. However, there was a lot of thuggery, there was a lot of intimidation, and this led people to conclude that it wasn't safe to go to the polling units in many cases. There was also snatching of the materials for the election, such as the BVAS machines where the accreditation of voters takes place. There was also incidents of vote buying that I mentioned as well, which seriously undermined the integrity of the entire process. So it was very unfortunate that this election took place in that context. And I think it undermines to a great degree the faith and trust that Nigerians have in the integrity of the electoral process overall.
People were expressing concern that INEC perhaps might have fixed some of the challenges to administer the gubernatorial elections better. Did you see that happening?
Yes, I think there was a definite change in the performance of INEC on Saturday in the gubernatorial compared to the presidential on the 25th of February. There was polling units opening on time. The sensitive materials associated with the election were available. And by and large, the election results were uploaded onto viewing portals for members of the public to look at in real time, which is what was expected. So in those terms, there were positives compared to the previous election. But it should also be pointed out two things. First of all, that because of the very low turnout, there was very little pressure on the electoral infrastructure. And secondly, the performance in the presidential was of such a low quality that it was almost impossible not to improve to some extent. But I don't want to take away from the fact that INEC did improve, as you suggest, between the 25th of February and the election on Saturday.
From what you have seen so far, what do you think INEC can do immediately to try to restore some confidence in the people?
Yeah, well, I think it's important, first of all, not to just focus on INEC. The problems about this election cannot be laid solely at their door. There also has to be political will to accept change and to improve the performance of the election. And we didn't see a lot of evidence of a political will to improve the performance of the election. But I suppose it is, as you say, too soon for us to draw conclusions and recommendations. And we will do that in the next few months before the end of June. But the two areas, I think, that require reform, and I don't think it's controversial to say so, is around the transparency of the overall process, which means INEC trying to improve on the availability of information to voters in order to restore their faith in the integrity of the entire process, but also in the inclusivity of the process. Less than 10% of the candidates in the state assembly and governorship elections were women. And this falls way below any standards that Nigeria sets for itself and effectively disenfranchises half the population. And so these are the two areas where you would imagine would require some reform in the immediate future.
What would be your message to the people of Nigeria following these two elections, two separate elections organized recently?
Well, I have to say I'm just amazed by the resilience and determination of the Nigerian people and their appetite for democracy. It's a real thing. It's impossible to ignore. We saw people queuing for hours in heat and in torrential rain to exercise a democratic right to choose their government. And I want to acknowledge that, first of all. I think, secondly, I would encourage all political participants that have a grievance with what happened over the last 3 or 4 weeks to pursue those grievances through the appropriate legal channels. This is the essence of a democracy. We find ways to settle our differences in a peaceful way.
Barry Andrews is the head of the EU poll observer mission to monitor the Nigeria elections. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, a human rights activist is calling for more courageous judges and respect for the judiciary to prevent chaos. Patrick Osagie Eholo, founder of the NGO and human rights group called One Love Foundation, says an independent judicial system will ensure nobody is above the law. His remarks come as presidential candidates former Vice President Atiku Abubakar and former Anambra State Governor Peter Obi petitioned the court seeking to challenge the outcome of the February 25 presidential election. Critics of the judiciary say the candidates are not likely to receive a favorable ruling from the court, saying the judiciary lacks independence and courage, criticisms the judiciary sharply denies. For more about his call for better judges, I reach Patrick Osagie Eholo.
We should respect the three arms of the government. But unfortunately, most cases we've been having in Nigeria have become cash and carry, the highest bidder. You know, if Nigeria is going to become an enviable state, it's going to become a better state, it's going to leave this, quagmire, we need some top judges, very disciplined judges, who are not money conscious, who swear to an oath that they are going to, you know, be law-abiding, they're going to, carry out justice, and, without respecting anybody, because everybody's above the law, you know? That's why I'm very worried. Because if we, like every other country that has laws, we have laws in Nigeria, but the issue is that we don't implement it. People get away with murder. I mean, look at what happened, for example, if there's law in this country, in these recent elections, how some sitting governors were just like openly committing an offense.
People have said in Nigeria that Nigeria's judiciary has demonstrated independence, and there have been some courageous judges who have, you know, respected and interpreted the law to the fullest.
I said I need more courageous judges, like what happened in the case of Abakari, one rogue cop, when the senior advocate were trying to twist the case that they didn't have the local standing. You know, you're not supposed to try this case. It's not your jurisdiction to try this case, something like that. You know, they had a twist in law sometimes, right? But it just told them, you know, that this is not about me not having the right to try the case. It's about an offense I've been committed. And, you know, you are saying that the police had to discipline them first before I tried the case. No, a crime is a crime. That means the judge has the courage. That means that with money offered, he declined to eat, because everybody in Nigeria thinks today they reduce the judges. They ask you, you know, limit. You want the money in Dubai, you want the money in Canada or in America. I am not saying there are no few good men or no few good judges, but there are one. There are one now in Nigeria currently in a million.
In your view, what will more courageous judges do, especially with these cases, talking about the election candidate going to court seeking redress?
What a courageous judge will do is look at what happened. Look at what is admissible or inadmissible. I'm not a lawyer, but some facts are very glaring. They use technicality to throw away cases they could try. You are from America, I live in Canada. What is the kind of people? We are already at war with ourselves because of hungry, because of unemployment. So such money should be used for infrastructure and other things, not to be put into security vote. But let me come back to your point again about the judges again. We have very few judges now who have the courage to do what is right because of money. And they know that it's true. And that's why this will tell you, go to court. If the criminals make law for you, can you get benefits in their court? No. Because somebody stole your bike and said, go to the station and report me. You know the father is the DPO. He has your bike with you. I said, go to the station.
Where do Nigerians go from here in your call for more courageous judges in the country?
In my view, I've assisted them in that area. I personally took the federal government to court that the judiciary should have truly independent. That is, you know, in the state, they should have their autonomy, because some of them, the governors still pay their salary. They don't have good allowances. They don't have good vehicles. They don't even have electricity in some of their houses or some of their office. They are supposed to be working sometime in the night to read and, you know, and do research. So let them give them a very good incentive. Let them give them an enabling environment. Let them treat them like judges. Let them have more respect for them so that they cannot be tempted in taking bribes from the executive or from the legislature. That's my own point.
Patrick Osagie Eholo is a human rights activist and founder of the NGO and human rights group called One Love Foundation. He spoke with me from Edo State, Nigeria. Direct from Nigeria. President Joe Biden and his administration are backing USBA to host Expo 2027. This after officials submitted a proposal to host a specialized expo in 2027 in Minnesota. It will be the first one in the United States in more than 40 years. The last was in 1984 in New Orleans. The U.S. bid faces a stiff competition from Argentina, Serbia, Spain, and Thailand. In line with the U.S. effort, the leader of the civil society group called Minnesota African United will lead a delegation to Paris this weekend. Basil Ajuo says his delegation plans to meet the top African envoys who will be voting to approve five countries vying to get a nod for their bid. To learn more about the effort of Minnesota African United to support U.S. Expo 2027, I reach Basil Ajuo via Skype.
As Minnesota Africa's diaspora community, we will be meeting one-on-one with dozens of African-based ambassadors who serve as the voting delegates to the Bureau International de Exposition. This body is this is our second delegation to Paris, and this is our fifth lobbying mission for the Minnesota U.S. Expo Beat. Last fall, we led the delegation to the United Nations General Assembly in the New York, and where we also lobbied head of state, foreign ministers, and other cabinet level officials from nearly 50 countries all across Africa. And we have been very, very proud of our success and very, very appreciative of the support and assistance we have enjoyed from the State Department and from our partners and colleagues at Expo USA, Minnesota US Expo, and the World's Fair Beat Educational Committee Fund.
Why is this important for the Minnesota African to have this expo in Minnesota, and how beneficial will it be for your group and members or Africans in the diaspora there?
The first reason why it is very, very crucial is because we are, first of all, thinking at the success of all the African diasporas who are here in the United States of America, and to help build the efforts that we are trying to push in order to advance a two-way trade and investment opportunities with partners back in our home countries on the continent of Africa. That's one of the first things that we are trying to push for this expo, because we see this expo as a gateway to success for African diaspora in the United States and a gateway to drive innovation and economic development, prosperity across the African continent.
So looking at some of the benefits, will your people in the diaspora there directly benefit? Because you have big businesses who will be doing big businesses during those months of the expo. And then how would you take advantage of this?
The first advantage of this is, first of all, taking advantage of the national network that is also here in the United States of America, taking advantage of all the networks that actually comes to the United States. And Minnesota has a reputation of welcoming new Americans from the entire planet. So as a friendly state, we think that our products, our services will be available on live, will be live streamed. People will know about our businesses. People will know about the work that we do. People will know about our home countries. People will know about small businesses, agricultural products, energy services, healthcare, and all these opportunities. These are possibilities. There is no way you can advance an economic interest and value of your home country when you are not able to compete at the world stage. This is the world stage that we are trying to make sure all African diaspora take advantage of, and all the continents of countries that are in Africa also take advantage of the opportunity that lies ahead of us.
What is your message to the people in the diaspora and to the African top envoys who will be voting soon to either confirm or support US's bid?
I think the Minnesota Expo the first message is that the Minnesota Expo will be a boost to economic development on both sides of the Atlantic, here in Minnesota and on the African continent. And a key approach to ensuring this is building upon legacies created by the Dubai Expo that happened in 2022. And we are trying to make sure that our successful approach is to reach worldwide audiences via digital, virtual programming, Expo Live programming. And we want to make sure that the time is actually now for an international exposition to bring the world to the heartland of the United States of America. And Minnesota is that place for this exposition to happen. The second message I want to send to the delegate is that, I want to send to African delegates is that we want to deepen our relationships with Minnesota. We want to deepen our relationship with the continent. We want to deepen our relationship with our African diaspora community as a long-term partnership to drive about development. One thing I just wanted to make you know is that I also serve on the board on the World's Fair Bid Educational Community Fund. And the reason why I joined this board was to make sure that all our diaspora organizations are full participants in the shaping of the Minnesota Expo, and to make sure the government in Africa have the resources they actually need to reap from the benefits that this expo has for every African nation.
Basil Ajuo is the leader of the civil society group called Minnesota African United. He spoke with me via Skype from Minnesota.
March is Women's History Month, and there's no better time to celebrate the accomplishments of women. Tell us about the woman that left positive marks in your life. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA is always happy to hear your voice. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
As the world celebrates the achievement of women during this International Women's Month, South Sudan female politicians say they face far more challenges than their male counterparts. Women take competition from influential men, cultural norms, and a lack of political will to support women continue to hold them back in their attempts to participate in politics and gain access to power. For VOA, Waki Simon Wudo reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
48-year-old Member of Parliament Dosmane Joyce Lesso has served in the South Sudan National Legislative Assembly for the past 13 years.
If there is any position that is there, first of all, people will start wrangling between men and women from the county. From the county, you will see that this county maybe want to send some people, and then you will see that a man will come and say that he will be the one taking that position. And if you are not a strong woman, you will not succeed in that position.
Joyce, who rose to prominence during the Sudan general elections of 2010, says a lack of political will from some political parties to respect women's rights and support women leaders poses a big obstacle to women's efforts to rise within South Sudan's power system. Joy says this is the reason the 35% share of government positions allocated to women as part of the affirmative action defined in the revitalized peace agreement is not being respected by the ruling SPLM party. Only one of South Sudan's 10 states has a female governor. Under the provisions in the peace deal, there should be at least 3 female governors. While women do compete in politics and the marketplace, South Sudan's patriarchal society makes women seem weak socially and economically, which limits their sphere of influence in society. Peterson Magola, country representative for UN Women in South Sudan, says the patriarchal society still restricts women's rights in the country. One big example, he says, is the persistence of child marriages. He says despite the law, statistics so child marriages continue to happen at the age of 15.
We are seeing some men not taking their children to school, the girls. And I've given you statistics. Over 70% of the South Sudan women are illiterate. Why? Because some of the men still have these tendencies that they cannot waste resources on a girl child to go to school. We are continuing to see the issues of the, you know, communal conflicts being, some of them being, you know, driven by cattle raiding and so on, because they still believe that, you know, we can take so many herds of cattle for, you know, to buy a woman. And when this woman is brought, she becomes a property to the man.
Several public discussions have been held on the barriers affecting women empowerment and how to combat injustices that continue to hold women back from rising to positions of power. Magola says more conversations are needed. Mary Akechi-Biore, a former lawmaker from the SPLM party, says it's time women rise up and take up positions of power. She says no one is going to give women what they want or deserve on a silver platter. They are going to have to fight for it.
There's no way you can just get a woman, pick a woman. Like, they have to come out from their houses. They have to come out wherever they are. I'm 100% sure women are qualified. They are educated. We have PhD holders. We have lawyers. We have doctors. We name them all. Even if my own daughter do not like to be a politician, I cannot force her.
Magola says despite the challenges, there is hope that things may change in the future. Transformational programs are being conducted by the government and UN Women that create awareness and educate women on their rights. Magola points out that recently partners finalized the development and a review of the country's National Action Plan, which was first developed in 2008.
I mean, the president recently at the women's conference came up very strongly and said he's going to support, the implementation of all recommendations that came from that conference, and was really pushing a lot in terms of even addressing the issues of patriarchal in the society. And also, we can see even from the leadership that recently a number of conventions, bills were passed.
Magola says UN Women is implementing a 7-month transformational leadership training project to empower women in South Sudan. He says the initiative focuses on grooming women for various levels of leadership. The project is being conducted in partnership with the University of Juba. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
To Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in the eastern region of Democratic Republic of Congo, the offensive by M23 rebels has pushed thousands of internally displaced people into camps on the outskirts of Goma City in North Kivu province. Overcrowding can lead to the spread of cholera. In the Bulengo camp, 2,125 cases of cholera have been reported in 2 weeks, according to health officials in the city, a situation that worries residents. For VOA, Zanem Neti Zaidi visited Bulengo and has the story.
In this cholera treatment room set up in the Bulengo camp by Doctors Without Borders, Mikaela Mutumai is caring her 8-year-old daughter who has diarrhea and vomits regularly. She says that the lack of clean water and latrines in the camp are the main causes of the epidemic. She says before they brought water to the camp, she paid 200 francs or under a dollar for a 20-liter container per day. There was only enough for drinking and cooking, but not enough to wash her children, who remained dirty. In the camp, there were no latrines. They used to relieve themselves in the bush because they had no other choice. Imjibu, the company responsible for water distribution in this part of the city, has increased its deliveries since the cholera outbreak began. The representative of the community, Baleke Buyana Prosper, says every morning 400 people are mobilized to spray the camp with chlorine in order to limit the spread of the epidemic. He says when they disinfect, they target the huts and the toilets close to them, and also chase away the numerous flies in the camp. They disinfect places where public bins are placed as well. To prevent the spread of the epidemic throughout the districts of Lac Vert, Emery Muhindo, the head nurse of the Buhimba Health Area, in which the Bulengo camp is located, is calling for health assistance from the Congolese government. He says that at the moment there are already latrines installed, but they are not enough. They are advocating for more latrines and water pipes connected to them. In this camp of internally displaced people, everyone with diarrhea is now considered a suspect case of cholera. Camp residents and leaders are asking all people of goodwill to help the vulnerable population. For VOA Africa, I'm Zane Mnetizaidi in Goma.
Would you like to be famous? Calling us on WhatsApp may gain you fame if we play your message on the radio. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. Here's that number again. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
Illegal fishing is a multi-billion dollar global industry closely linked to organized crime. The trade will pose a greater threat to security as climate change warms the world's oceans, according to a report from Britain's Royal United Services Institute. For VOA, Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
Illegal, unreported and unregulated fishing, or IUU fishing, is worth up to $36.4 billion annually and represents up to 33% of the global catch, according to a report from Britain's Royal United Services Institute, a defence and security think tank. As climate change warms the world's oceans, fish stocks move into cooler, deeper waters, and criminal operations are expected to follow. Lauren Young is a co-author of the report.
Chasing those fish stocks as they move. And there's predictions, obviously, or concern that they will move in across, you know, existing maritime boundaries, and, you know, IU actors will pursue them across those boundaries.
That, in turn, will impact local coastal fishing communities. Again, Lauren Young.
As their livelihoods, they become more vulnerable, that they may begin engaging more in IUU practices, like destructive fishing practices, or engaging in other type of criminal activity as well. There is a nexus with other crime types as well, like narcotics, human trafficking, labour abuses.
Many poorer countries do not have the capacity to police their waters. In parts of Africa and South America, coastal community members say foreign trawlers, including vessels from China, have devastated fish stocks. Alfred Oja is a fisherman from Cameroon.
When the Chinese were not here, at least if a fisherman goes to the sea, he can at least have something good for a day. But for nowadays, it's not really easy for us fishermen. Yeah, things are tough.
China denies its fleets conduct illegal fishing. The United States Coast Guard said in 2021 that IUU fishing had replaced piracy as the leading global maritime security threat. The British report identifies a warming South China Sea as a flashpoint. Already, fishing grounds and maritime boundaries are hotly contested, with frequent armed confrontations. Again, Lauren Young of the Royal United Services Institute.
Many relate to China's commitment to the Nine Dash Line, which is its country's sort of self-declared kind of maritime boundary. And that is, they enforce that through armed fishing militia. That plays into it a lot as well. But those existing tensions there are likely to be exacerbated by climate change. And I mean, that is in line with predictions, you know, of climate change being this kind of threat multiplier.
This month, United Nations member states agreed to a high seas treaty to protect biodiversity, establishing vast marine protected areas. Again, Lauren Young.
Whilst it's, you know, positive move with climate change, that we're looking to protect more, you know, more of the world's oceans, we need to improve our ability to be able to actually monitor and enforce them as well.
The report authors call for governments and multinational bodies to tackle illegal fishing activity based on climate change predictions, enhance vessel monitoring capabilities, and toughen enforcement in recognition of the role the illegal fishing industry plays in wider criminal networks. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Rusesabagina has been released from a Rwandan prison, according to U.S. officials, after the Rwandan government commuted his prison sentence following diplomatic efforts by the United States. Rusesabagina, once a hotel manager in Rwanda's capital, Kigali, is credited with saving hundreds of lives during the country's 1994 genocide. His actions inspired the Hollywood film Hotel Rwanda. U.S. officials say Rusesabagina was released from prison shortly before midnight Friday and was taken to the residence of the Qatari ambassador in Kigali. They say he will likely stay there a couple of days before flying to Qatar, which helped to broker his release. The 68-year-old Rwandan hotelier-turned-dissident had been jailed in Rwanda since August 2020, when a plane he believed was headed for Burundi instead landed in Kigali. After he left the plane, he was tried and convicted on a number of terrorism-related charges the following year over his ties to an organization opposed to President Paul Kagame's rule. Rusesabagina, who denied the charges, was sentenced to 25 years in prison. LGBTQ leader in Uganda says he and others are worried about becoming homeless after the passage of a harsh new anti-gay bill passed by Parliament. The head of the banned group Sexual Minorities Uganda, Frank Mugisha, says he does not own property and could be expelled by landlords, rendering him without a place to live. The new legislation could land LGBTQ people to life in prison for admitting they are gay and be put to death for what the parliament calls aggravated homosexuality, which can include infecting others with HIV. No similar law punishes heterosexual adults for the same actions. Those defending or promoting the LGBT community can serve up to 20 years in prison. 389 legislators supported the bill, and the two that did not were taunted as homosexualists. The move comes amid press reports alleging sodomy in boarding schools. President Yoweri Museveni, who says homosexuality is not African, has not indicated if he will sign the bill. The U.S. and many other Western countries are urging Museveni to block the legislation. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Sana na wewe siku tarajia kuwa mbali na wewe akimeniacha babaya kutengana na wewe imenibadilisha sana nimetamani nilewe akina kunywa na sasa mandambia nini watu rejina haya mapenzi yalinoga na kumbuka tulipeana majina leo baby kesho tomato mitandao Kesi tukakubali tutabu
In star signs, but you're a Gemini. Wait, I mean, every time I look at you, I start to cry. Okay, that's cap, but when I see you, I get butter. Nah, that line be used up way too many times.
Yep.
I wish that I could make the stars speak, just so they could tell of your beauty. You're heaven sent, but when you smile, you're one hell of a cutie. Baby, I'm telling you truly, listen to me, this is how cool you are. But then again, you're such a hottie, one day, ukalungula. Just joking, boo, I'm just trying to explain that your love is like amnesia. It makes me forget pain, forget plain. I'm here to be loyal, boo, I'll never break your heart, but rest assured, I'm here to spoil you. It's just you and I, baby. In the world of our own, where this love is our home, my love is do or die for you. Ain't nothing could change the way I feel. My love is the root to you. You get the gist of being like you should not exist. That's why they hate that you're my boo. I see them hurt, them haters pissed. It's like they're sharing cubicles. Baby, you are beautiful. At times I brag to myself, I brag me the unusual. I mean it, girl. Your type is not seen on the daily. Baby, you a goddess. There ain't nothing they could tell me. I hope you know how great you are. I hope I make you feel it too. I know I get crazy with love, but it's hard to conceal it, boo. You make me wanna touch the sun. Too much? Okay. Well, that's just how you got me stunned. You get my thoughts an endless run. You will always be the one that I wanna come home to. I don't need no other, yeah, I told you you're my go-to. It's just you and I, baby. In the world of our own, where this love is our home. My love is do or die for you. Ain't nothing could change the way I feel. My love is
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightland Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightland team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a paddle here, a paddle there, the canoe stays still. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good